people that it is a really significant resource and that they are paying a lot of attention to it.
Oh, absolutely. Within the industry, we've had an industry representative tell us that the Eagle Ford could be and the term he used was a game changer because it is so big. And the industry already is starting to tout what it's done for the state of Texas, created it by its estimates about 400,000 jobs, and pumped into the Texas economy about $2.6 billion. Texas itself, when you look at its budget, has collected about $7 billion in taxes from the Eagle Ford already. So it is a big player there.
Well,
but on the
continue, yes.
But on the other side of it being a big player, there are a lot of small folks there who have lost their voice in what's happening to not only their own property, but to their homeland of South Texas.
Well, I wanted to talk about what's in this play. Is it just oil or is it also natural gas?
It's both. It's oil and natural gas. And what's most significant about this play in the oil is that there's a high concentration of hydrogen sulfide. This is a very deadly gas that in low concentrations can cause physiological reactions, and in high concentrations it can kill. And as is true with this type of oil and gas from shale, there are any number of volatile organic compounds associated with it. Benzene, toluene. These are all chemicals that have an effect on the central nervous system, can cause headaches, respiratory illnesses, and this sort of thing. People in the Eagle Ford are beginning to complain of those sort of symptoms when they find themselves surrounded by oil and gas developments. The same kind of symptoms that people in Pennsylvania have been complaining about in the Marcellus region. So the types of emissions create the same sort of health effects that we're seeing across the country.
Well, they've been drilling for oil in Texas for a really long time. So what makes this particular project so much different from the traditional kinds of oil drilling that happened in Texas?
Well, you're right. Texas, is oil drilling and oil derricks in Texas. They're iconic pictures. It's as iconic as a longhorn steer. What's different is the traditional drilling is the pump jack where you drill straight down, find a big pool of oil, and pump it out. This is hydrological fracturing, where the oil is trapped in layers in hard shale formations. So the companies have to go down and then start drilling horizontally. Once they've drilled horizontally, they pump in under extremely high pressure fluids, primarily water, but mixed with chemicals, including diesel, and a sandy mixture. And what it does, it forces this mixture into the cracks in the shale and basically breaks the shale open so that they can then go in and recover the oil and gas. And associated with that is the leftover fluids that are used to break open the rock. So that's another issue that has to be dealt with in this particular sort of oil and gas development. Once these fluids are used to break open the shale, then they have to be disposed of. And there's a lot of concern that they're not being disposed of properly, and that the chemicals used in the operation itself are unhealthy.
Well, in the images in the video, a couple of things that stood out to me is all those flares, and that seems to be a really big part of the operation. The other one I saw looked like, remind me of the tailings ponds up in the tar sands in Alberta, but they look like ponds that are, I'm assuming that's where they're putting the waste for now. So I wanted to talk about those two things. Are the flares, is there more flaring when you frack for oil than when you do conventional drilling?
No, there really isn't. What happens is that once a well is tapped, the natural gas has to be either siphoned off, captured for sale, and piped away, or it has to be burned off, because There are so many volatile organic compounds. Again, the naturally occurring benzene, toluene, that, you know, are carcinogens, cause respiratory distress, as well as contributors to greenhouse gases. So it has to be dealt with. The best way to deal with it is to capture it and pipe it off for sale. The second way that it's dealt with is by burning it off. And the flares, depending on how well the flares do, they can burn between or burn up to about 90 some percent of the volatile organic compounds. If the flares aren't economical and they're not working properly, they can vent tremendous amounts of pollutants into the air.
My understanding, actually, is we're having a similar problem perhaps being proposed for us here in the Northwest with a very, very large oil terminal being proposed for Vancouver, Washington. And when they're transferring the oil from the trains to the ships, there's a lot of loss of some of these really nasty effluents. And they're talking about flaring them. And I heard a percentage, like it was going to be a very small percentage, actually, that was going to be burnt off, and a lot of which is going to go into the atmosphere. So it seems like flares are not a very effective way of getting rid of these very noxious chemicals.
More obviously, more effective than simply just venting without flaring. The EPA, though, is beginning to require more and more capturing of these gases, as opposed to either letting them vent or be flared off.
Well, it seems like it would make economic sense to capture them, since isn't natural gas another fuel that is very much desired? In fact, desired a lot more in a lot of ways than oil or coal.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the Eagle Ford play, you know, is as dependent. It captures as much gas as it does oil for that very reason. What we found is that the development in the Eagle Ford is happening so quickly. Already there have been about 7,000 wells drilled, and there are permits for about another 5,000. Is what's happening is that the development is outpacing the infrastructure. They can't get enough pipelines in to capture the gas because the wells are hopscotching across this very rural area of Texas so quickly that the pipeline companies can't keep up with the oil and gas development. So the companies are left with no other alternative but to flare it at this point.
Well, the other question I had earlier was, what are those pools of water that I saw in the video? Are those, in fact, pools where they're just storing the contaminated fluids that they use for fracking?
Yes, that's it. When the fluid comes back out of the ground, it's oftentimes just put in open, unlined pits. Other times, it's trucked away and what they call injected into another well. They dispose of it underground by drilling another well and just putting it in a hole in the ground. And one of the things that is happening is that the disposal companies are taking over abandoned oil wells that have been played out, and using those wells to dispose of the contaminated water.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with David Hassemeyer, who's a co-author of an 8-month investigation into fracking the Eagle Ford shale. That's a joint collaboration between Inside Climate News, which David works with, the Center for Public Integrity, and the Weather Channel. And we're talking this morning about this rather amazing energy extraction project going on in South Texas that very few people know about, but hopefully through this report, a lot more people will find out about it. The people that you show in the video and that you describe in your report are dealing with, seems like, a much more intensive problem, the byproduct of fracking, than what we've been hearing in the past from people who have to deal with the Marcellus shale fracking or people in Colorado. It's one thing to have your water contaminated, but what do you do when your air is contaminated?
And that's one of the reasons that Inside Climate News, the Center for Public Integrity, and the Weather Channel decided to take a look at emissions. It's because a lot has been written about and addressed in terms of water quality and what it does to water. We decided that let's take a look and see what happens when these emissions escape into the air. And it's what we're finding is that there's not an awful lot known about what's happening in the Eagle Ford because there's not a good body of air monitoring data available that builds a baseline on what's being emitted, how much is being emitted, and how it's affecting people. So the emissions issue is a tremendous issue for folks down there because, quite simply, nobody really knows from the regulatory agencies to scientists. There's just not enough known about what's happening.
Well, let's talk a bit about one of the problems there. What about what kind of regulation is there in Texas, and what does the government know about what's going on there?
The agency primarily responsible for regulating emissions in Texas, including emissions from oil and gas development, is the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. They will tell you that they have a very strict permitting process by which they limit the amount of emissions going into the air. They'll also tell you that they have a very efficient follow-up and investigative arm of the agency that will follow up on complaints. What we found is that their permitting system is so lenient that in many cases it allows the developers to self-report the emissions. And in some cases, in many cases, hundreds of cases, the TCEQ doesn't know of the existence of some of these facilities, so they can't really track it. In the Eagle Ford region, there are five permanent air monitors for an area that is almost twice the size of the state of Massachusetts. Only five permanent air monitors, and they are located on the perimeter of the Eagle Ford, not in the areas where the oil and gas development is taking place. And it was explained to us that that was done on purpose, because what TCEQ is looking for with these air monitors is what is migrating outside of the boundaries of the Eagle Ford and how it may be affecting the larger population centers. And the nearest large population center is San Antonio. So TCEQ purposely locates its air monitors away from the source emissions because, as they say, they don't want to be overwhelmed by what's coming out of an oil and gas well. So there's very little monitoring, and that monitoring has yielded very little information on how people are being affected by the emissions.
So on the basis of that, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality claims that there's no harm being done by all the incredible escalation of fracking that's going on in the Eagle Shale in Eagle Ford.
Yes. Although we found some internal communications that we obtained under the Texas Public Information Act from TCEQ that indicates that the agency itself does have some concerns. In one case, one of the TCEQ executives wrote that there are a lot of emission events, a lot of emissions that TCEQ just doesn't have a good handle on. So even the agency internally is questioning the extent and the consequences of emissions.
Well, I'm actually working on a project right now about tar sands in Canada, and was talking to some people who are describing how the Canadian Energy Board, which kind of reminds me a little bit of the Texas Environmental Quality Commission, that a lot of their funding is actually now coming from fees that are paid by the oil companies. So, in fact, in Canada, the board that's supposed to be regulating and controlling and monitoring and perhaps fining companies that are extracting all the oil in Canada has a kind of a conflict of interest, because it's really in their best interest in terms of their finances to keep approving these projects. Is the same situation true with the Texan Environmental Quality Commission?
TCEQ is primarily funded through taxpayer dollars in Texas. And is what we found in taking a look at the TCEQ budget is that beginning in 2008, about the same time of the beginning of the boom in the Eagle Ford, the Texas legislature cut TCEQ's budget by almost 40%. And to show some context for that, during the same period of time, the entire budget of the state of Texas was cut only 8%, and the budget in the governor's office was cut 2%. So TCEQ, as an agency, has sustained some significant budget cuts. At the same time, there's just been an explosion in oil and gas development and the need for monitoring in the state.
But what kind of relationship does the commission have with the oil industry? I mean, are they seen as being pretty much, is there a lot of, let's say, exchange between people who are working for the oil industry and people who are working at the commission? Or is there actually a wall of separation?
The commissioners are appointed by the governor of Texas, Rick Perry. Rick Perry, as governor, has made it known that he would like to see the EPA disbanded. The Attorney General of Texas, who's one of the front runners now to replace Perry as governor of Texas, has sued the EPA almost 18 times over various issues. Texas is a very pro-business state, and consequently, if it sees that anything is going to be an impediment to that business and to the growth of business in the state, it encourages that to that business. And, you know, in this case, the commissioners are appointed by Perry, a very pro-business person. So when we talked with various environmental groups, as well as even some what I would call unbiased people in the Eagle Ford region, some city managers, some other local officials, they just simply say that TCEQ is very pro-oil and gas. There is one member of the state legislature. His name is Lon Burnham. He has tried repeatedly over the years to legislate stricter standards on the industry, unsuccessfully. He calls the state of Texas and the Texas legislature a wholly owned subsidiary of the oil and gas industry.
That sounds like it's probably true throughout much of the world where there's petrostates, and I guess Texas is one of the largest petrostates in the world. I'm looking at a quote in your article from the Chief Administrative Officer of Karnes County, County Judge Barbara Shaw. She says, we've always have fears. She says that Karnes County is ground zero, I guess, for this kind of oil and gas exploration. We always have fears that the federal government is going to stop it. So what are those fears, and what does that show about the relationship between Texas and the federal government?
Texas and the federal government don't have a good relationship. The state has sued the EPA 18 times over the last 12 years to prevent the EPA from imposing tighter regulations and requiring Texas to more closely regulate emissions from the state. I can't presume to say what Barbara Shaw had in mind when she said, you know, our fear is that the federal government will stop this. Other than in Karnes County, in 2008, again when the Eagle Ford was beginning to boom, Karnes County received about $400 million in taxes from the oil and gas industry, or the base value was about $400 million. Last year, that figure exploded to about $6 billion. So there's tremendous economic incentive for these localities to encourage oil and gas development.
Well, I want to get back to hydrogen sulfide, which we touched on the beginning of the show. And you were talking about how there's, quite a bit of hydrogen sulfide contained in the shale that contains the oil that they're fracking in the Eagle Ford play. But I also understand the Bakken, that hydrogen sulfide is a big issue there because the gas that's fracked there, the oil that's fracked there, is very high in hydrogen sulfide, and that's being theorized. That's why all those coal trains are exploding that are carrying Bakken oil. So is there that much difference between the hydrogen sulfide content in the Eagle Ford and in the Bakken?
I honestly don't know. And what little I know about hydrogen sulfide and its effect, if it's, you know, being tanked out as part of the oil from the Bakken, it's very corrosive. And so I think there's some thought to maybe hydrogen sulfide is a contributing factor to the deterioration of the rail cars. In Texas, It's a very real fear. When you come up to an oil and gas site in Texas, one of the things that seems a little out of place are fluorescent orange wind socks. And each oil and gas site, you know, has between two and half a dozen of these orange wind socks. And for me, it just seemed a little odd and out of place until somebody told me what those are is... they are warning signs that if there is a release of hydrogen sulfide, people are supposed to look at those wind socks, see which way the wind is blowing, and then run in the opposite direction because they want to get away from the hydrogen sulfide. And a couple of the TCEQ investigative reports that we read, and we reviewed almost 300 investigative files that were generated based on complaints of residents of the Eagle Ford. In a couple of occasions, TCEQ's own investigators went out to sites to check on emissions that were reported to them by people in the area. They set up their equipment. They set up air monitoring equipment. They used infrared cameras to take a look at what was being vented that was unseen by the naked eye. When they'd set up their instruments, they would find the amount of hydrogen sulfide and other volatile organic chemicals were so high that they essentially had to flee for their own safety. So it is a major concern in this region.
So what is anything being done, or is this just, are they sort of overlooking this issue? Is it overlooking the other toxic releases that are so prevalent in the Eagle Ford shale?
Hydrogen sulfide, like all other volatile organic compounds, are permitted. TCEQ allows a certain amount of hydrogen sulfide and other VOCs to be vented. What we have found is oftentimes... the companies exceed the permitted amount that can be vented. And on other occasions, as we discussed earlier, TCEQ itself doesn't know how much is being vented because it allows the oil and gas development companies to basically self-report. And sometimes they underreport, sometimes they don't report at all. In reviewing the investigative files again, we found a couple of instances in which an oil and gas well should have sought a permit because it was a sour well. And a sour well is a well that produces a lot of hydrogen sulfide. But because of Texas's lenient permitting process, this company didn't obtain a permit for hydrogen sulfide and was emitting hydrogen sulfide for more than a year before TCEQ discovered it. So there's just lax regulation and oversight of the industry, you know, in terms of the hydrogen sulfide and other chemicals being emitted.
So what brought this whole concern to your attention and to the other forces that have helped to put together the report that you did?
You know, we became aware, just generally aware of the Eagle Ford, and thought that we needed to take a look at the state of Texas and use the Eagle Ford as an example of what's happening in the state of Texas, and perhaps as a cautionary tale for across the country. And we, again, sat back and we realized that a lot of reporting and research had been done into how this sort of development impacts the water. But not a lot had been done about what happens when all of this stuff is emitted into the air. So it was just kind of a gathering of forces. You know, the Eagle Ford was booming, and it's a tale of, at the beginning, how was it regulated? And then the story that, again, states across the country can take a look at and see what's happening in Texas, you know, in terms of is the regulation sufficient? What is happening to the health of people in the region? How much is known about what is happening to the health of people in the region? How much is being monitored? How is it being monitored? Again, all issues that have importance to every state in which fracking is taking place. So we thought it would just simply be, you know, a good example to take a look at and raise the new issue of air emissions.
Now, were you surprised by the findings that you found with the air emissions and the health stories that you uncovered?
What we found is that there still isn't an awful lot known. So I think, surprised, I don't know. What we learned is that there's just not a lot of monitoring going on, that there's just not a lot of study going on to determine what is really being emitted and the consequences of those emissions.
So what are some of the health problems that you came across in your investigation?
I talked with one Eagle Ford resident, a resident of Collins County, who had been a lifelong asthmatic, but one who was living with it. And once the Eagle Ford began to develop, and her home was surrounded by dozens of wells and processing plants, that her asthma would flare up sometimes a couple of times a day, whereas in the past, maybe once every month she had to deal with it. She described to me driving from driving in the region and needing to keep her medicine, inhalers and injectors, right at hand, because she says that oftentimes she'd be driving and the emissions would hit her and she would come close to blacking out. And so she needed her medication close at hand because she was afraid of blacking out while she was driving. She can no longer sit outside. Her and her husband had long thought about making that part of Texas their retirement home, and they bought a ranch house. Her husband built this deck that looks out over the Texas prairie. And for years, they would sit out and they would watch the sunsets on this deck. They can't do that any longer because of the emissions, is what they're telling us.
Well, it sounds like a lot of the stories are the same, where people can't go outside anymore.
Yes.
And, there's one of the stories that really struck me was the one about the organic farmers, because that seems to be, it's a little bit more intense than just not being able to watch the sunset on your deck. So let's talk a little bit about that farm and how it's being impacted.
This is a young family who has taken over their family's farm. The land has been in the family for, since the 1960s, I believe. And it had originally been just a typical farm until the younger generation came along and wanted to make it something special, wanted to make it an organic farm. It's farmed by a young couple who were in school studying agriculture because they wanted to make a difference somehow. They wanted to change kind of a lifestyle, and they decided that one of the ways that they could do it, kind of a small step at a time, is to turn their farm and their ranch into an organic farm and ranch. What their concerns are is now that oil and gas development is beginning to encircle their, and it's almost a 500-acre ranch and farm, is that it will have an effect on what they grow and on their livestock, in that the livestock will be breathing the same, the emissions, will be eating grasses that, you know, may be covered with the residue of these emissions. So they're concerned that they may not be able to say that they are completely organic because of the emissions and the effect that it's having, you know, on their livestock and on what they grow.
Well, do these people have any kind of recourse? Because it sounds from the report that there's a lot of people whose lives are really being disrupted, if not destroyed, by all this oil and gas development.
The recourse that they have is to turn to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. And we've had that discussion about TCEQ and how it is dominated by pro-business people. They tell us that they are very frustrated, that they have very few places to turn. They feel genuinely disenfranchised from the regulatory process because they say TCEQ isn't all that responsive to them. They also tell us that whenever they try to make changes through the legislative process, that they're met with great indifference and oftentimes hostility is what they're telling us. And when we took a look at who the people are in the legislature making the decisions, we found that about 40% of the folks serving in the Texas House and the Texas Senate have either a personal investment in the oil and gas industry or their spouse has a personal investment. They are either getting royalties from land that they own, they have stock investment in the oil and gas development companies in the Eagle Ford. And while, you know, the legislature say that they are not, their thought process is not affected by that, you still, you know, lay it out that some of these lawmakers are receiving and reporting more than $1 million annually in income from the oil and gas industry. So when you talk to people like the organic farmers, they say, "Wait a minute, how can we fight the money? Who can we turn to take our side and to even, at the minimum, listen to us and our complaints?"
And that's a good question. Who can they turn to? And what can happen? I mean, this, besides your report, which I'm hoping is going to open a lot more eyes and minds to what's going on, is there any alternative for these people?
One of the families has hired a personal attorney, and they have brought litigation against an oil development company that has built a dozen or so facilities within 2 miles of their home. So, yeah, what they're faced with is fighting City Hall as individuals. I certainly hope you're right that that folks will take time to look at our series and read our series, and I'm sure you'll tell folks that they can find it at insideclimatenews.org.
We're actually going to have, we have links on our website to Inside Climate Link. I'm also going to put a link to the video on the Weather Channel.
Excellent.
So I really do urge people to check out your full report because it's It's very disturbing, is the main thing I can say. I keep thinking about how people can fight this. And one thing that's inspiring to me is the city of Richmond, California, which has long been in the shadow of the Chevron refinery, is now suing Chevron as a result of the fire a year and a half ago. And it's a community that was once completely a company town for Chevron, but they have had a change of leadership and certainly a change of consciousness. And I'm wondering if the same thing might happen in these counties in the Eagle Ford Shale play area, and also what might happen if these fumes made it all the way to San Antonio. Would then the political winds shift a little bit?
It may well, because that's essentially what happened with the Barnett region that was encroaching on Dallas-Fort Worth. There are many, many more air monitoring stations in the Barnett than there are in the Eagle Ford, because the Barnett is more highly populated, and that population may be a little bit more sophisticated and know how to bring attention to the issues. So yeah, certainly that the demographics plays a huge role in it. We talked to a former TCEQ commissioner who kind of looked at the demographics of the Eagle Ford, and he said, you know what, this is a demographics that just won't draw much attention and concern in the state capital. So yeah, certainly the fact that the Eagle Ford is very rural and it's got a large minority population, the thought is that the policymakers and the regulators may not pay as much attention to the Eagle Ford as it does in other areas of the state.
So I guess it's up to the rest of us to help them put the pressure on. So I want to thank you very much for joining us, David. It's been really great talking to you.
My pleasure, and thank you for bringing this to light.
And I might want to talk with you some about Dilbit sometime in the future, because that's what I'm studying myself right now.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, great. Well, we've been talking this morning with David Hassemeyer, co-author of Fracking the Eagle Ford Shale, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus, and we'll have links to the report, Inside Climate News' report, as well as to video that's on the Climate on the Weather Channel about fracking the Eagle Ford Shale. Next week, we'll be talking with Helen Yost, who's with Wild Idaho Rising Tide. We'll be talking about the latest megalodes crossing through Oregon, Idaho, and Montana on their way to the tar sands. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Tom Waits. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to KBOO throughout the day.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon, walk the straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. You gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
KBOO. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the March selection for the monthly Jefferson High School Multicultural Film Festival. This month, the film The Canary Effect will show on Tuesday, March 11th. The Canary Effect is a 2006 documentary that looks into the effects that the United States and its policies have on the indigenous population. That's The Canary Effect, Tuesday, March 11th at 6 p.m. at the North Killingsworth Library. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it is 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. He speaks with science writer Judy Foreman about her book, A Nation in Pain. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, host Will Hall speaks with suicide attempt survivor David Webb, author of Thinking About Suicide, Contemplating and Comprehending the Urge to Die, about suicidal feelings and how talking openly about them is the best form of suicide prevention. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com. And this KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, with 5 part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment. The Hallmarks of a Liberal Arts Perspective, March 6th Information Session, merrillhurst.edu.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Judy Foreman, is a nationally syndicated health columnist whose columns have appeared regularly in the Boston Globe, Los Angeles Times, and Dallas Morning News. She has a master's degree from Harvard Graduate School of Education, served as a fellow in medical ethics at Harvard Medical School, and has been the host of a weekly call-in radio show on healthtalk.com. She's here today on Health Watch to talk about her new book, A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Welcome to Health Watch, Judy Foreman.
Thank you, David. It's nice to be here.
So as your title suggests, our nation's biggest health problem, how exactly large is the problem?
It's exactly very, very large. The number is officially 100 million Americans living in adult pain. And that number comes from a very prestigious source, which is the Institute of Medicine, which your listeners probably know is part of the National Academy of Sciences. And the number of 100 million actually is probably an underestimate because it doesn't count kids, it doesn't count people in the military, and it doesn't count people in nursing homes. So it is a very large number. People are usually shocked when they hear it, but it's bigger than cancer and heart disease and diabetes all combined. I should say that in this 100 million, there's a degree of suffering. Some people have relatively moderate pain, but an estimated 10 to 30%, so that's a sizable chunk of people, are living in severe disabling pain. So it really is a big problem, but it's kind of like a hidden epidemic. A lot of people don't think about it.
So given that it is so widespread, so common, why is it that doctors seem to know so little about managing it?
Because they don't learn much about pain in medical school is the short answer. There was a very good study a couple years ago by Johns Hopkins University researchers, and they looked at 117 medical schools across the country in Canada, and they found that the median number of hours spent learning about pain over 4 years of medical school was 9. That's not very many, given that pain, chronic pain, is the main reason people wind up going to doctors in the first place. So the really big infrastructure problem, or one of two that I see, is the lack of pain education in medical schools. And I would kind of challenge your listeners to, next time they go to the doctor, you know, ask your doctor, you know, just in a nice way, how much pain education he or she got in medical school. And they'll probably be embarrassed and look a little sheepish and say, God, you know, practically none. I've been doing that with my own doctors, and, you know, they all kind of admit, in fact, in surveys, doctors say that they're very concerned that they don't know as much about pain as they wish they did.
And why would you think that medical schools wouldn't teach it in proportion to how often people would see it in a practice as a doctor?
I don't think that's how medical schools are set up. In fact, I had one prominent neurosurgeon from your part of the country tell me that medical schools are kind of the last bastion of feudalism in this country, that they're really very kind of hidebound and doing things the way they've always done it, which is a lot of lectures, and it's very turfy. You know, if you're a professor in a medical school and you've been teaching XYZ for 20 years, you don't want to give up that turf or your claim on your students' hours so somebody else can teach a different topic. And medical schools, I think, don't tend to organize themselves around what brings patients to doctors. They have sort of a more academic orientation, but ultimately that doesn't really serve the mission of medicine as well as it could.
One of the more interesting sections of A Nation in Pain for me was your section on gender. And
yeah,
it was fascinating to learn that women are not only more likely to get painful conditions, but also more likely to experience more pain from the same condition. And this includes osteoarthritis, TMJ, headaches, neck pain, sinus pain. What are some of the theories why women would be more likely to get painful conditions and also experience more pain?
Yeah, and also to be undertreated or dismissed a little bit more often than men. Nobody really knows why, but hormones clearly play some sort of a role. Up until puberty, boys and girls have roughly the same amount of pain, and not very much, because they're, by and large, they're healthy kids.